Welcome to Space Strategy, a podcast from the American Foreign Policy Council's Space Policy Initiative, where we are shaping a vision for the next strategic frontier. Now here's your host, AFPC Senior Fellow in Defense Studies, Peter Gerritsen.
Welcome to the Space Strategy Podcast. Today, my guest is Dr. Simon Pete Worden, Chairman of the Breakthrough Prize Foundation and Executive Director of the Foundation's Breakthrough Initiatives. And I will say, one of my personal heroes and mentors. His career has been unique, touching nearly every aspect of civil, commercial, and military space innovation. He has been an Air Force General Officer, a NASA Center Director, a Professor of Astronomy, Planetary Sciences, and Optical Sciences, a consultant to DARPA, a Congressional Fellow and Advisor on Space Issues to the Senate, and a Military Commander. He has served twice in the White House, first in the Office of Science and Technology Policy, and later as Director, Advanced Concepts, Science and Technology of the National Space Council. His military career included technology development, operations, requirements, strategy, policy, and even arms control negotiation. He has served as the Deputy for Technology for the Ballistic Missile Defense Organization, the Director of Analysis and Engineering for the Space Warfare Center, the Deputy Director of Requirements for Air Force Space Command, the Deputy for Battle Space Dominance at Headquarters Air Force, the Deputy Director of Operational Requirements for Headquarters Air Force, the Vice Director of Operations at Headquarters U.S. Space Command, the Director of Development and Transformation of the Space and Missile Systems Center in Air Force Space Command, the forerunner of today's Space Systems Command, and he commanded the 50th Space Wing, which operated most of the nation's military satellites and which has evolved and split into the Space Force's Delta 5, Delta 8, and Delta 9. At the time, General Worden was responsible for more than 60 Department of Defense satellites and more than 6,000 people and 23 worldwide locations. He was among the earliest space power advocates and advocates for a separate space force, and as well as one of the earliest space power theorists. Worden has played a key role in building the modern space ecosystem we take for granted today and continues to build technologies enabling an exciting far-term future. Throughout the 1980s and early 1990s, Worden served in every phase of development, including international negotiations and implementation of the Strategic Defense Initiative. Worden was a key early innovator and proponent in the area of small satellites. While at the Ballistic Missile Defense Organization and its predecessor, the Strategic Defense Initiative Organization, he played major roles in the development of the DCX, the precursor to today's reusable rockets, and the Clementine mission, a small, low-cost, and rapidly developed satellite which mapped the moon and found water, as well as tested sensor and propulsion technology for space-based and exo-atmospheric missile interceptors. As the Vice Director of Operations for Headquarters U.S. Space Command, he testified to Congress on the relationship between asteroids, planetary defense, strategic stability, and preventing an accidental nuclear war. As Director of Development and Transformation at the Space and Missile Systems Center, he was responsible for policy and direction for force enhancement, space support, space control, force application, and computer network defense. While there in 2003, he outlined a vision for usable launch vehicles, responsive space microsatellites, and cislunar spaced awareness and planetary defense that is only now being realized. As a professor of astronomy, optical sciences, and planetary sciences at the University of Arizona, his primary research direction was the development of large space optics for national security and scientific purposes and near-Earth asteroids. There, he developed ideas for an L1 sunshade for geoengineering, a solution to mitigate climate change, and the mission concept that would evolve to become NASA's Planetary Defense Double Asteroid Redirect Test, or DART. As a DARPA consultant, Worden played a key role in starting the reusable rocket and responsive space evolution now being taken forward in our National Security Space Launch and Space Development Agency. As the NASA Center Director, Worden was behind the GEOINT singularity and large LEO smallsat revolution, including the efforts that eventually became Planet Labs and Planet, and oversaw the Lunar Crater Observing and Sensing Satellite, or LCROSS, which confirmed the presence of water on the lunar poles as a precursor to NASA's return to the moon. He has authored or co-authored more than 150 scientific technical papers in astrophysics, space sciences, strategic studies, and at least two books, with one forthcoming. Now, as chairman of Breakthrough, Warden has initiated efforts to search for life in the universe, search for technosignatures of intelligent life, and is developing interstellar spacecraft and propulsion systems to send probes to survey exoplanets and neighboring stars. There is virtually no aspect of Space 2.0 that Dr. Warden has not touched or pushed. Please enjoy our far-reaching big ideas conversation on cislunar, the moon, NASA, Space Force, DARPA, asteroids, interstellar, aliens, planetary defense, John Boyd's philosophy, officership, and advice to innovators. And now I give you Dr. Simon Pete Warden. Dr. Warden, thank you so much for taking time to come on the podcast. So I want to start with a little bit of self-introduction. So how do you describe what you do and your role in the space ecosystem?
Well, I guess I probably the best description is I'm a space iconoclast, that I believe that there's a better way to do things. We need to find it. But secondly, I'm also a bit of a futurist, that I think that humanity's future is in space, and that you'll find out the further in space, the better.
So, you know, that's a great start. And so let's jump right into that. So paint me a vision of how you see our future and what we ought to be striving towards.
Well, let me say at the start that I don't think we've really entered space yet. I mean, I consider low Earth orbit not even space. We're fooling around in the harbor. Cislunar space is sort of like, playing around in an inland sea. True space is in the solar system, and real true space is beyond, and in the interstellar space. So I think at the start, it's really to say that I believe in an unlimited future for humanity. But that not only necessitates, but requires that we go beyond our solar system and as far beyond as we can for a lot of reasons. One is that there are risks in certainly in one planet species, but in even one solar system species. Ultimately, there's probably a risk in one galaxy species. But I've always been kind of a fan for an unlimited future. And I think that, it's all right to be focused on cislunar space because the first offshore island is the moon. But the real focus should be on the entire solar system, and then try to really focus on how we get to the nearby stars and what's there. So that's sort of always been my objective. My father just died a few years ago. He was 98. And as fathers do, he had kept sort of clippings of newspaper and other clippings of when I was a kid. And when I had graduated from the University of Michigan in 1971, began to date me a little bit, there was a local newspaper, somebody, did an interview with me. And it starts out, it says, this kid believes we'll be doing interstellar probes in his lifetime. And my dad looks at me and sort of grins and says, well, at least you're consistent. I was about 70 at the time. So that's always been my focus. I've always felt this solar system is boring. You know, if there's other life here, it's sort of microbial. And ever since, again, I was a little kid, I had my mother gave me two books to read when I was about 6 years old. I think she's probably the first book she bought for me. And one of them was called Planets, and the other was called Stars. And I thought the Planets one was boring because I couldn't see any evidence of there's no exciting aliens or anything. But it mentioned in the Stars one, there could be aliens on planets orbiting the nearby stars. So that's been my sort of life's work. And as my dad said, I am pretty consistent.
So you've given us already, a ton of hooks to get into. You've given us cislunar, you've given us interstellar, you've given us aliens. Let's start at the beginning, because I think many people do not actually appreciate why cislunar is important and what it could offer to humanity. So let me let you give the spiel on why cislunar is important.
Well, I think that, you know, as a physicist, the most important thing to worry about in space is gravity. And, you know, if, you know, real space doesn't begin until you start to get really free of Earth's gravity. And then the cislunar space is defined as the region that's dominated not just by the Earth, but the sum of the Earth-Moon gravitational system, which is in itself a rotating system. Rotates with the lunar orbit, but that's a you know, you can kind of think of that as, you know, again, I called it a sort of a enclosed lake, large lake, and I think first and foremost it's important to operate inside your lake, or you know, you might expand a little bit and say the Roman Empire was the Mediterranean Sea, and it's that there's clearly a large object. I mean, it's you know, it has the area of a continent on Earth, so it's really the additional continent that has a couple of key features. One is it has lots of resources, but more to the point, it's really closer to the edge of getting into the solar system than the Earth's surface is. So I feel that it's really critical. The other thing is that when you operate in cislunar space, and it really begins, you know, somewhere fairly close to geosynchronous orbit, your propulsion requirements and so on are dictated by this Earth-Moon gravitational system, which is classically what's a Roche geometry. It has equilibrium points and unstable equilibrium and stable equilibrium. Those are kind of equivalent maybe to the sea choke points of centuries past. So I think the point is that once you're in this sort of cislunar space, it's relatively easy to get any place else, particularly if you're at some of these equilibrium points. So it doesn't require a lot of energy. You know, I think that, you know, quite often we're used to thinking of, well, something is close in number of kilometers, but you really need to think it's close in terms of gravity. It's how much energy you need to move from one point to another. So it's cislunar space is that geometry and those dynamics, particularly relating to propulsion, are going to dictate our ability to move around. It'll dictate national security and international security. You're going to have to know what's going on in there, because somebody sitting on the other side of the planet is actually much closer to you than somebody that might only be a few thousand kilometers away, depending on where they are. And it's so I'd say that the very first thing that we need to have is space domain awareness of the cislunar space. We need the ability to move around in it. And those are different propulsion systems than chemical rockets that get us off the surface of the planet. I think, you know, the higher efficiency systems, whether they're solar electric or even nuclear thermal or nuclear electric, my particular favorite is solar-driven light sails. I think we'll be entering a new era of sail craft that makes it quite easy to get around in cislunar space. Using sunlight is just like using wind. You don't have to spend any energy.
Now, you had also mentioned early on as the moon sort of being this first island. So let's talk a little bit about the strategic importance of the moon.
Well, it's, you know, as an offshore island, it sort of dominates everything. I mean, it orbits the planet rotates underneath it. So it's always accessible from really any place in the planet, which means that any place in the planet is accessible from it. But probably more to the point is that it's an immense resource in terms of mass. I mean, it's a planetary mass object that it's a lot easier to take material from the moon than it is to bring it from the Earth from energetic standpoint, even and including bringing it all the way back down to low Earth orbit. So it's a huge resource. As we're learning increasingly, it has all of the resources the Earth does, including volatiles such as water. The Indian landing of the South Pole this week was significant because it's near the poles that those water resources are confirmed, and they may be much larger than we originally thought. And I think one of the key objectives of the Chandrayaan mission is to start looking at those resources, and it will be followed by other missions, including US and no doubt Chinese missions as well. Resources are incredibly important. They were the things that dominated economic and great power politics in centuries past. Easily accessible resources are going to be a key aspect. Another one, as one I mentioned, is that the ability to get places in throughout cislunar space from a certain point with minimum energy. From some of these points, everything else is downhill. You know, that's a critical aspect if you don't require much energy to get to some other place in the system. And those other places could include places that are critical for communications, surveillance, and so forth, even of the Earth.
So, you know, you were talking about cislunar before. I mean, today cislunar is a buzzword across multiple communities, but, you know, you were talking about it in your book on space power theory and scenarios with General Shaw in 2002, and you were briefing it at NIAC seminars about that same time when you were the in charge of transformation for the Space and Missile Center, today the Space Systems Command. When you think about cislunar, how closely is that tied to near-Earth objects in your mind?
Well, the near-Earth objects are the next step out. And these are, you know, okay, we have a large offshore island. We have hundreds of thousands, not millions, of small islands scattered throughout the inner solar system. Some of them are actually easier to get to than from the lunar surface from an energetic standpoint. They may take longer to get to, but I think in space, people need to think in terms of energy it takes to move places that, in some sense, that's more important than time. And it's, you know, these small islands that in some cases, they may be much more accessible than the lunar surface is. There are some of them, for example, that are nearly pure volatiles, including, you know, maybe 50-60% water. These are the sort of icy asteroids.
By the way, just a backup for the audience, who maybe all of the audience wouldn't understand the term volatiles. What does that mean?
A volatile typically means a compound of carbon, usually one that's liquid or gas. But water is usually included as a volatile, even though it's not a carbon molecule. But generally, volatiles are, I mean, for example, things like gasoline, methane, a lot of the fuels that we understand, and water. So it's more correct to refer to these sort of, and they're called volatile compounds because they tend to be at very low temperatures ices. So they're sort of a solid, but they vaporize at sometimes, you know, negative temperatures Fahrenheit, but sometimes, I mean, obviously 32 degrees is when water volatilizes. Some of them have an intermediate phase depending on the pressure of a liquid, so they can be pumped and stored as liquids. Particularly the carbon volatiles have a lot of energy. If you burn them with oxygen, that's the basis of all of our fuels, whether it's methane or you're breaking water apart into hydrogen and oxygen, or kerosene for that matter. Those are all volatiles. And the volatiles are also critical for life because they have carbon. And having a large store of volatiles is going to be necessary to creating a stable ecosystem off the planet. That most of what we're made of are volatiles with a little bit of trace of other elements.
So do you see that possible? I mean, many people are skeptical that we will ever have a foothold off planet or in the solar system. How do you see that developing?
Well, I think the people that are skeptical are idiots. But not understanding that people go where they can go. They like to say, oh, well, we don't know whether people could live at 1/3 or 1/6 gravity. I suspect they can. I mean, that's unfortunately one of the things that NASA should have done and hasn't. But, the lunar gravity is 1/6. I'm almost 100% certain that Earth life will be able to thrive in that. There may be a few minor things that have to be changed, and you may, in some cases, re-engineer life, genetic engineering. I mean, it'll happen naturally after a period of time. That if you have the resources, and it's primarily volatiles, but I mean, there's traces of other things that all exist on the moon, by the way. You have everything you need for life. Now, people say, well, there's a high radiation environment. Well, there's a high radiation environment if you're sitting out on the surface. Many parts of our planet aren't very hospitable if you're sitting out on the surface and you build shelter. To my mind, one of the most exciting places on the moon for large-scale habitations are the so-called lava tubes. The moon was formed, you know, about the same time as the Earth, maybe slightly thereafter, so some 4.5 billion years ago. About 4 billion years ago, there was probably what we call the late heavy bombardment. There was large asteroids that hit both the Earth and the moon. But those sort of created huge seas of lava on the lunar surface. They probably did on the Earth too. But as those cooled, the lava flowed out of the certain areas of this and made what they do in lava lakes on the Earth. There's lava tubes. And these things cool after a while. We can see the remnants of the lava tubes in some places on the moon. They're called sinuous rills. These are where they've collapsed. But we also see places that are they haven't collapsed. And there's a couple areas where there's so-called skylights that you can see that down below the skylight is a huge empty area, which probably runs for many, many kilometers. Those are sort of natural places to put human habitations because they're already underground, so they're going to be protected from radiation. You can build a city and seal it, and then you can provide with power from the surface or nuclear power, everything one needs. So I don't believe this is a terribly difficult thing to do. And these lava tubes, people think of little things that are 5 or 10 feet across. If you look at an artist's conception of the couple we know of, these are big enough to put the whole city of Philadelphia in them, which might be a better place to put Philadelphia. Wow. Right now, you know.
So we have billionaires that I think you, in at least a couple of your jobs, have been able to rub noses with, who have visions of becoming multiplanetary, of creating a city and perhaps even terraforming Mars, and of creating free-flying space habitats for billions or trillions of human beings in the solar system. What are your thoughts on those?
Well, I mean, I can't think of a better goal to do. I may differ on the location and the timing, but I mean, it's not my money, it's theirs. But I think it's important to have visionary individuals, high net worth people. And I think this is very much consistent with history, that throughout history, new settlements were financed by individuals or small groups of individuals that had a lot of resources. In some cases, they controlled the government. In other cases, they had, you know, what we call private wealth. But virtually all of the expansion, and I suspect this extends to expansion that isn't written about, like the Polynesian expansion, that she had some individual that had a bit of power or influence and decided that he or she wanted to go someplace else and finance building the ships and so forth. So I think it's a very positive thing. You know, some people have talked more about it than others, but I don't think because it's a private individual that maybe the initial impetus that it doesn't also involve governments and public organizations as well. I think that we're going to see sort of an expansion that's funded by, in some cases, wealthy individuals, in some cases, you know, visionary aspects of governments, other cases, consortia, and probably ultimately private corporations. Does that give us complexity? Yes. In conflict, possibly. But that's our challenge, is to do that in a peaceful, mutually acceptable sort of manner.
So you have twice served at the White House trying to revitalize America's civil space program. And we are finally focused on the moon, and we have Artemis. So how do you evaluate our current efforts and focus on the moon, and how does it stack up against the vision of where you'd like to see us go?
Well, I've been, most people know that I'm sort of a critic of NASA, and there's probably a lot of quotes, some of them fortunate, some of them unfortunate, that I've made. And when I was a NASA employee, this was the kind of things I was pushing for. And it's good to see that you can teach an old dog new tricks. I think the Artemis program is very well thought out. I mean, there's certainly, to be sure, there's things that I would criticize. You know, those are more in the details than in the fundamental direction. One of the most important things of the Artemis program is the Artemis Accords. where they're really trying to build a international framework that this expansion can happen in a peaceful way that does allow and even emphasizes private and collaborative public-private development. I mean, to me, one of the great accomplishments here was just before India lands on the moon, they signed the Artemis Accords. So we now have, you know, most of the countries that are able to get to the moon that have signed it. I mean, one would hope that the few holdouts, particularly China, eventually sign it, and I suspect they will. It's more in their interest to collaborate than not. The other key thing about the Artemis Accords is the emphasis on public-private partnerships and private efforts. You know, obviously the SpaceX transportation one is a big one, plus Blue Origin and others that are also involved in this. To me, though, one of the most important aspects, which I was very pleased to see, is the commercial lunar payload services, the CLPS program, that is quietly developing, that you know, funding the ability to put payloads on the moon, 100 kilograms or so, for, you know, 100 million or so. In fact, one of these is my own foundation is very excited about this because we're looking at potentially putting a radio observatory on the far side of the moon. That's an area that's shielded from interference from the Earth. And it's our best shot of being able to see if there are radio signals from other civilizations that we might be able to detect. It's awfully hard to do it on the surface of the Earth just because there's so much interference.
So that's fantastic. And I think there are folks across our government that are helping with that. So, you know, you used to be a consultant at the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, on space. And I remember having you out to the Pentagon during that that time period when you were working on a diversity of things, including standing up what became SpaceX and Falcon 1 under the Falcon program. Today, DARPA has a number of programs that seem to be tending towards creating this kind of ecosystem and industrial revolution in space, such as the NOMAD program, the DRACO program, the BSHER program, and the brand new Luna 10 that aims to create scalable commercial infrastructure. What do you think about DARPA's entree into this, and what role do they have in building out this ecosystem?
Well, DARPA is a unique asset for the United States. I know other agencies and other countries have tried to imitate it. The key to DARPA is that it has no corporate memory. There's no permanent staff. I mean, there's a few support people that write contracts and so on. But the director is usually only there, you know, one administration. The program managers are only there for a few years, typically four. The only way they can stay longer if they get made an office director, which is then eight. So that you have an organization, first of all, that, as you and I probably have known, you go in and talk to the big boss in most organizations, and the big boss tells you, you come up with some new idea, say, why don't we do this? Oh, we looked at that 20 years ago, that's stupid. And those kind of things get dismissed. DARPA, there's nobody to do that, because nobody's been there 20 years to say we tried that 20 years ago. The second thing is it has a lot of money. You know, I think its budget is $3 or $4 billion. Now that's real money. And the third thing is it empowers their program managers. The program managers come from all over. They come from academic backgrounds, corporate backgrounds, civilian government backgrounds, and military. Now, I never was a DARPA program manager, but it's sort of the coolest job in the world. You get there and you know you've been hired for 4 years, and you've been told you're going to go away after 4 years. So for the first 2 years, you're given somebody else's program to finish. And those are usually cool programs and something you're interested in. But the first 2 years you're there, you are able to start a number of seedlings. These are sort of million-dollar class things. You go to somebody and say, hey, I'm really interested in fusion propulsion. And and it's pretty much up to you. I mean, you got to answer a few of the Heilmeier questions, or kind of critical questions. Is this completely stupid, or does it have any use? But those are usually pretty straightforward. Assuming that's the case, if you're a program manager, you say, okay, here's $1 million. And then in 2 years, if it looks promising, you can start a new major program that may have hundreds of millions or even a billion. That's a unique thing where one person can do stuff. The only other place that one person can do things is if you made the billions yourself. I mean, you know, some of the private rocket companies have, but it gives a chance for particularly a younger expert to really, you know, have a grub stake in starting something really new. So I think it's a unique organization. Probably another reason it's successful is because it's not overmanaged. There's a tradition that both Congress and the DoD bureaucrats are sort of chased out and say, look, you know, if you want new stuff, give us the money and go away. And yes, understand we're going to make mistakes. I mean, some of the, you know, the sort of big DARPA successes are always touted, but there are big DARPA failures too. I was told there was one a long time ago called Hushaboom. It was some Air Force nutty idea that some DARPA program manager, can you make a quiet explosive? You know, which violated some laws of physics, but they spent, you know, a few hundred thousand on that and decided, okay, this violates too many laws of physics.
So you were one of the earliest, most vocal and most consistent voices for space power or Space Force independence, and you consistently mentored many of the advocates. You held key positions at both Air Force Space Command Air Force Space Command and the earlier Space Command. And you mentored students for what became today's Space Force Schriever Scholars. And way back in like 2015, 2016, you gave a quote that starts off a student paper called Movement and Maneuver in Deep Space that I'll post as a link. And the quote is that essentially the DoD needs to focus on true strategic objectives in space. These are objectives for the coming century. True space operations will spread across the solar system in the decades ahead, and the nation that controls them will dominate the planet. Focusing on low Earth orbit is akin to having a Navy that never leaves sight of the shore. The US military needs to focus on blue water space operations, geo and above. US military space operations need to be in deep space, initially all of cislunar space with an eye toward the entire inner solar system. To operate in deep space, we'll need the resources there, starting with fuel from the asteroids. Once this is recognized, the military economic imperative of identifying and protecting these assets becomes clear. The focus should be on low-cost access to real outer space, with space beginning at geo. New means of moving around space are more important than just getting off the ground. How is our Space Force doing?
Well, that's a good question. Good start they've got. You know, one of my concerns is that there's still too much interference from the Air Force. You know, I think there's a lot of view, I think, on the other services, particularly the Air Force, that, well, you're there to support us, which is baloney. I sort of go back in some sense, I think the Space Force would have been better if it came out of the Navy, says the former Air Force guy. The reason for that, if you go back to the U.S. Constitution, it specifies two kinds of military, and it's very explicit. It says that the government has the authority to raise an army from time to time, but will provide for a Navy. And there's a couple of reasons for that, and I think those are valid today. First of all, armies are usually have the possibility of being an instrument of suppression. And that was clearly the founder's concern. And I think it's a concern that maybe is not great, but it's still the instruments of suppression of, you know, public, you know, open public discourse are always a possibility. But more to the point that having a large standing military tends to encourage foreign adventurism. And so, you know, and I mean, I'm not to get into all of the politics, but I think smaller standing armies is a good idea, and I include air forces as part of that, because it always encourages doing something unilaterally, which I think is a bad idea. Now, the second thing is that the Navy was stood up, and why did they say provide for? And the reason is they felt that a Navy was critical to protecting commerce, and so it was really a commercial thing. And to my mind, the Space Force has that function much more than fighting wars and carrying on, sort of foreign adventures and so forth. So I think it's really important that Space Force understands that, that as we see greatly increased commerce, particularly in cislunar space and beyond, that it's their job to and to work with other nations to provide a secure, predictable environment. You know, this is what navies do on the surface of the ocean and underneath the ocean. If you have a number of navies, there have been very few naval battles in the last, you know, three quarters of a century. And I think that that's partly due because the navies are really there for protecting commerce, protecting economic security. So it, so I would say that the Space Force, I would look at it much more as an instrument of economic security rather than an instrument of war fighting. And the more we do that, I think the better. And it, you know, there's some of that certainly in the people I know that in the Space Force, but, you know, I'm not sure that the, you know, sort of broader Pentagon and national security community understands that.
So some of the things that they do seem to have understand are things that you've been championing for an extremely long time. So, you know, it finally looks like the Space Force is starting to embrace reusability and these proliferated large, small satellite constellations. And, you know, I encourage you to add, you know, some color and history, but I'll at least mention that you were in the Space Defense Initiative organization that pioneered the DCX, and I know you were behind that. Then at DARPA, I know you had a big role in the Falcon program that became Falcon 1. You were also part of the SmallSat revolution, trying to get us to do responsive space for decades. And then, of course, the Clementine mission, which is, I think, a piece of history that almost no guardians today know about. So, you know, talk a little bit about the history of these ideas that now the Space Development Agency within the Space Force is pursuing. You know, let's talk reusability and proliferated LEO and you know, where did those things come from?
Well, there's a lot of different sources of that, but you know, I think that my interest in the small proliferated satellites really started in, you know, I was at the White House in 1989, 1991 at the National Space Council, and my responsibility was to work the Space Exploration Initiative, which was a failed attempt to revitalize civil space, and our big challenge was that a lot of people wanted to put money into, they had something called Mission to Planet Earth. And now I don't consider anything that deals with the Earth have anything to do with space. So I'm, you know, that, you know, people say, oh, we do want to do Earth science. Okay, you can do Earth science, but that's not space stuff. That's just high altitude airplanes. So that, but they were going to put tens of billions of dollars into this giant space station that had all these sensors, and they were going to cost a few billion each in $1990 dollars. And I said, well, why can't, rather than have a single satellite with 46 sensors on it, why not put one sensor on each satellite? And, you know, of course, that was heresy. And in the end, that's kind of what we did. And it so it began to push that. But at the same time, you know, I was involved in the missile defense program. We'd been looking at different ways to do effective missile defense. One of those is, you know, giant laser battle stations. You know, another one was, you know, taking a nuclear device and converting the energy to X-rays for some X-ray lasers, various kinds of things that really were Star Wars. But the best idea came through, why not just have little missiles, little small satellites that could hit another missile? You know, they were called smart rocks. There was a group at Lawrence Livermore Lab that was run by a brilliant physicist, bit of a character, Lowell Wood, who said, well, these could be even smaller. And he'd been a protege of Edward Teller's. And so he developed something called the brilliant pebbles that were even smarter and smaller. Now, some wag said, well, the next thing will be genius sand, but that's probably right. The ability to build, you know, capabilities in tens of kilograms means you can proliferate them, they're survivable, and they're cheap. It really, I think, gave rise you know, to the kind of small sat movement. You know, small sats are sort of, you know, hundreds of kilograms. You know, by the end of the 90s, you know, people started to say, well, why can't you build things in the kilogram class? The, you know, I was an early adopter when I went to NASA in 2006 of CubeSats. The, of course, initially everybody regarded those as toys. And they initially were just sort of ways to teach students how to build spacecraft that didn't cost a lot of money. But now that's the mainstay of Earth observing is small sats and CubeSats. I think the revolution that's just starting is how do you get those things deeper in space? And start, you know, that's beginning. Of course, the next step, in my view, are the genius sand level. Rather than kilograms, why can't you make these things tens of grams or 100 grams? And that started, although that's being resisted by idiots in the U.S. government that don't like the idea of these little things. They're trying to say, well, it's very difficult to get communications licenses. Of course, at the same time, my foundation, we're trying to do interstellar probes. And the only way we can figure out to get something to 20% the speed of light is they only weigh a few grams. So the but these are revolutions that I think you have to understand where technology is going and what it does and how it can help. You know, the first thing was small, cheap, proliferated. The second question is now, how do you get the stuff there? You know, I've been a big advocate of small launchers. But reusability is, I don't understand why people didn't get this. But, you know, the best analogy that was used from 40 years ago was, look, if you build an airplane that it could do one flight across the Atlantic, you know, that the wings fell off when it, you know, and the engines and so on, and you end up just getting the passengers there, there wouldn't be intercontinental air transport. You know, you can't build a new airplane every time. So why not do it in space? Now, you can only carry that so far. The issue is that you know, I think sometimes there are premature efforts. You know, the NASA's Delta Star, whatever they called it, was a hypersonic
Venture Star,
and a few others that, you know, that you can only expect so many miracles in a decade, and there were too many miracles in series that had to happen, but. You know, we are seeing now that reusability is clearly what is making giving us cheap access to space. I think, to my mind, one thing I didn't foresee, which is really cool, is the and it probably makes sense that you can actually do bigger things even cheaper and do them reusable. You know, and like the Starship, SpaceX Starship, is incredible because I think it gives us the ability to put a lot of mass up. Now, as they're already doing, those are proliferated small satellites in many cases, but in some cases they won't.
So you had this important role in the strategic defense in space-based missile defense, which of course has not come to fruition, but you even wrote a book, SDI and its Alternatives. You know, I'm curious whether or not you still are a proponent or see the relevance of it, given that, you know, this force application that at one point you were in charge of requirements for, now we have competitors who are actually launching fractional orbital bombardment, you know, system tests. What do you think? Is there continuing relevance for the idea of space-based missile defense?
Well, I think there's maybe a stronger need today than there ever was to base security on dissuasion, and which is a step before deterrence, and to move away from offensive capabilities. The war in Ukraine is raising again the specter of nuclear warfare. Now, the purpose of the missile defense program 30 years ago wasn't to eliminate the ability to get a nuclear weapon through. It was to make it incredibly difficult to accomplish anything militarily with it. And I believe that the ability to say that if you want to do something offensively and aggressive, you're very unlikely to succeed. You may get cause some damage, but it'll cost you a lot. And there's a high barrier to you succeeding, which isn't it better to figure out some other way to get your objectives than to attack somebody? I think that's more valid today than ever. It's the essence of security. I've always been like to emphasize that the purpose of a military is to prevent wars, not to fight them. And once you have to fight something, you've failed. So it's I hated that term, the war fighter. I mean, you're supposed to be a war preventer, not a war fighter. And that's why I felt that, having very strong ability to protect your economic assets, including assets that are in space, particularly in space, the ability to minimize the ability for somebody to attack from long distances, especially through space, is critical to that. And it, I haven't paid a lot of attention to the details of national security other than reading the newspapers or the, listening to blogs and so forth. But I think now more than ever, those are critical.
So I wanted to come back to Clementine because it's such a fascinating story. And I will routinely hear people in the Department of Defense make claims that it's not the role of the DoD to do science or to support industry. And the cleverness of what was accomplished, or the other thing that's kind of involved in this is, in rereading your bio, I see that you were involved in like all phases of arms talk negotiations during SDI. And so it's not seemed to me that there is the same level of strategic savvy and engagement in terms of setting the conditions for the entire domain to include both the development of threatening technology and the negotiating of it. But tell the story of Clementine and what it accomplished.
Well, maybe I can start by talking more about what was the purpose of the Missile Defense Initiative, the Strategic Defense Initiative, or sometimes called Star Wars, which wasn't a bad name, by the way. It was applied to it by Teddy Kennedy to be insulting. The whole objective of that was to change the game. And I guess if our competition with the Soviet Union was two different approaches clashing. I think somebody wrote that, the Soviets, as the Russians are today, are good chess players. And if you let them freeze the rules, they'll eventually beat you, because they're good at multiple planning ahead. On the other hand, the West, and particularly the United States, is damn good at poker. And if you can change the game frequently, and particularly change the game in areas where you've got a very strong hand, then you're going to win. Much of the Cold War was, I saw, seeing the Soviet Union trying to freeze the rules and get us to play chess. And we were stupid enough to do that for a long time. And I think Ronald Reagan and his advisors understood that we really needed to change the game because we were going to lose. And so they decided to change the game. And I don't think initially it was that changing the game was necessarily space, although it turns out that, in my opinion, and the more we looked at it, that was what changed the game so strongly. And I sort of liken this to, in fact, I sometimes refer to it as the great 50-year space war that started with the V-2s. And it was really a 1-2 punch. The Soviets saw that the U.S., when we went into space with the Apollo program, beat them decisively. Then they went back to sort of, let's see if we can freeze the rules again with arms control and other things. But the missile defense program increasingly was, let's change the game by using space. And that was an area that the Soviets tried to compete with us, but I think it was a straw that broke the camel's back. And it was clear to me, having been in Geneva and talked to a lot of the Soviets, that it was the space stuff that scared the bejesus out of them. And because they said, okay, the U.S., if they really put their mind to it, can really beat us badly there. The fact that we never actually had to build anything and we ended the Cold War, now there'll be a big argument, what was the key factor? I'm convinced that the space part of the missile defense program was a major factor, maybe the major factor. And I know a lot of experts think I'm wrong, but they're full of shit. And they weren't there. So that having been said, one of the things we looked at, what can we do in space that in some sense recalls Apollo and shows that, okay, deeper and deeper in space, you're going to see us beating you. And so the idea was, as I said, we're looking at these small satellites. At the same time, when I was at the White House, they were, NASA was trying to restart the moon program, but they wanted to do it by tripling the size of the space station and building a dozen more space shuttles, a more ignorant approach, I can't imagine. So our point was, why don't you look at the new directions, small, cheap things. And so we took a, in fact, the concept was actually hashed out in a bar near the White House with a colleague of mine who had a somewhat checkered career since then. Stu knows that, but a brilliant guy. We were there at this bar, I think it was called Quigley's, to meet a congressional staffer. I think it was Jeff Tudor was his name. And he was late. So we started saying, bemoaning NASA's inability to do things. Why can't we just modify these brilliant pebbles we were making and send one to the moon? Stu actually sketched that out on a napkin. And so we went back, thought this is a good idea. And Mike Griffin was the head of technology at the Star Wars program. And so he started a study. And about a year and a half later, I took over his job. And the study was kind of collecting dust. And I said, let's go do this. Of course, the problem was people said, well, it might violate the, you know, things that we would do in space that look like weapons could violate the anti-ballistic missile treaty. So we had some clever lawyers and said, well, if everything we tested on missile defense was done in lunar orbit, and not in Earth orbit, does that violate it? And they sort of scratched their head and said, no, actually not. So we got the program started. Now, I will say we kind of slipped it through congressional oversight, because I figured if we'd actually put something in there, say we're going to do a Star Wars probe to the moon, that probably would have got zeroed. So there was something at that time called, you had to put descriptive summaries in. And these were like, I was the head of technology, and there was probably 300 pages of descriptive summaries. So deep in the sensor area, we had sensor integration experiment. We said we're going to test these sensors in Earth orbit and in deep space, including cislunar space. The staffers on the Hill didn't understand what that meant, so they didn't knock it out. So after we started this program, one of the congressional staffers there called me up and said, you're ordered to stop this program. It wasn't approved. And I said, yes, it was. Said that it was in the descriptive summaries. You know, it was passed by both houses of Congress and signed by the president. It's in law. And so we actually got the thing through. Now, it ended up, it was sitting on the launch pad when the change of administration, the Clinton administration came in, who wasn't very happy about space stuff. But I think they didn't pay much. It took them a year to get their act together. I don't think they even realized what this thing was. It was sitting on the launch pad at Vandenberg Air Force Base and going to the moon. So nobody stopped it. So it went to the moon. And to my mind, it was not just that it was a critical strategic item, but it also began to focus, you know, our overall attention, including national security attention on cislunar space and beyond. The second part of it was supposed to go and intercept an asteroid, but that we had a software error and that stopped, that failed it. But it was that was a really cool mission.
So just because you didn't mention it, correct me if I'm wrong, this tested most of the components that were needed to space qualify the Brilliant Pebble system, and it was the first indication or the first discovery of water on the moon that completely changed our view of the moon as a strategically, logistically important body.
Yeah, that's correct. It basically demonstrated the key capabilities to do affordable space-based interceptors. It also got the first, you know, full seven-color map of the moon, for a lot of useful for resources. But probably one of the most significant aspects is it was the first positive indication of that there is substantial quantities of water in the lunar polar craters. And and that was kind of an added benefit. So yes, it was a, you know, I kind of got fired over it, but it was worth it.
And why was it called Clementine?
Well, again, the people that started it, we had a lot of drinks in bars, and we said, look, NASA keeps naming things after some, you know, ancient Greek or Roman, you know, gods, you know, why don't we use a good American name? You know, one of my favorite songs was My Darling Clementine. You know, I said we should name this mission Clementine. As it turned out, it was going to be lost and gone forever, which it was. And so it was an appropriate name. So I kind of like the idea of using something out of American history, not ancient Greek history.
So let's pivot now to the farthest reaches and talk to me about Breakthrough and Interstellar, and both, you know, Breakthrough Listen and Breakthrough Starshot.
Well, you know, I, when I was at NASA, that, you know, I was frustrated that we didn't really do a lot beyond the solar system. I mean, you know, one of our neatest missions was the Clementine mission. So in the science mission, or not Clementine, I mean, the Kepler mission, which basically found that every star in the galaxy essentially has planetary systems, at least in a statistical sense. And a lot of them have planets like the Earth in the habitable zone. But most of those stars are pretty far away. They were hundreds or thousands of light years away. So I had a strong interest in, you know, why don't we look at the nearby star systems? Because those are things that, that are in our future in the next century or even less. It didn't get very far with NASA. We did studies and so on. But, you know, being in Silicon Valley, you know, I was the senior civil servant in Silicon Valley. So it meant I got invited to a lot of billionaire parties, mostly as entertainment. But so I met a lot of these folks. And as an astronomer, I, you know, well aware that in the, you know, the 19th century and even the 20th century, most big telescopes are built privately, you know, the including today, you know, the most of the big telescopes have a substantial or even majority private funding. So I kept hitting up the billionaires. And finally, one of them, you know, got excited about it, Yuri Milner. And so I got to talking to him. And about, by this time, it was clear that I wasn't going to stay at NASA forever. I'd caused enough trouble. And, you know, Yuri had been the principal founder of the Breakthrough Prize, which is the largest science prize. It's $3 million. Basically, it's the attempt to highlight the accomplishments of basic scientists. But he also wanted to do research on the big questions of life in the universe. And there are really three of them. And the first one is there any life elsewhere? The second one is, if there is there any, and I hesitate to use the word intelligence, I'd call it is there a techno-signature somewhere or a techno-civilization somewhere else that we can detect? And the third one is, can we really think about sending probes this century to the nearest star systems? So we started the program, and Mr. Milner has dedicated several hundred million to the three programs. The life in the universe is, in general, is Breakthrough Watch. The search for extraterrestrial intelligence or technosignatures is called Breakthrough Listen. And then the interstellar probe is Breakthrough Starshot. Those have been going on Breakthrough Watch. We're about to fund some more programs, but the first one we funded was a joint program with the European Southern Observatory that we were able to tentatively detect a giant planet orbiting in the habitable zone of one of the stars in the Alpha Centauri system. The Alpha Centauri system is 4.3 light years away. It has three stars. Two of them are about the size of the sun. And they orbit around each other every 80 years. The third one is very distant. But we now have tentative indication of a planet in the habitable zone of one of the most solar-type stars. By the way, that's the same scenario that was in Avatar. So James Cameron has been quite excited about this. There was a giant planet orbiting in the habitable zone of Alpha Centauri A that has moons, one of which is called Pandora in his movies. So we're glad to kind of prove that science fiction may be real. But we also did some studies on looking for life in our own solar system. A couple of places we're looking at the moons of the outer planets, but also on Venus. There's some tentative evidence of life in the upper atmosphere of Venus, although it's quite controversial. So we did some studies, funded some studies by Professor Sarah Seeger at MIT. She now is working with Rocket Lab to send a probe there in a couple of years that can begin to look for life. Another foundation has actually funded the instrument, but we work closely with them. And so we're about to start more programs to look for, you know, particularly at Alpha Centauri and some of the nearby stars. So that's very exciting. The second program, Breakthrough Listen, we're just in the process of opening a, you know, European office of it. There'll be announcements out pretty soon on that one in the UK. And I guess that's not Europe anymore. That one, we've got time on most of the world's large radio and many of the large optical telescopes. We did 3 years ago had the first tentative detection of a signal that looked like what we call a technosignature. We're now almost 100% convinced it was caused by radio interference. It's very hard to do these in the surface of the Earth. So we're starting to look at, can you put a sensor or a radio telescope on the far side of the moon? But that program is going very well. We're now convinced if there is a signal to be seen, we can see it. The third one, Breakthrough Starshot, we are just completing the first phase of that. The only way we could figure out with technology we understand to send a probe to the nearest star is to have the probe only weigh a few grams and attach it to a light sail, which is a 4 or 5 meter diameter, very thin material, which you then erect in space and you hit it with a 100 gigawatt class laser, which is a really big honking laser. And you hit it for about 10, 20 minutes, accelerates it to 20% light speed, and then it coasts through interstellar space for 20, 25 years, flies by planets in the Alpha Centauri system, and we now know of several, and takes images and other data and sends it back by a laser beam. And that the first phase looks pretty promising. This is a long-term program. These things probably couldn't be launched till later this century. But to my mind, it's the first evidence that we have that our civilization can actually reach interstellar distances. So I'm very excited about those three programs. They really are addressing, my life's interest is the nearby stars, finding life, maybe finding aliens.
Are you optimistic? If you were to plug in numbers in the Drake equation, are you optimistic that there are other living civilizations? And if so, as somebody who thinks both on the civil and national security side, how do you see that?
Let me say I'm optimistic that probably even this decade we're going to find life elsewhere, whether it's in our solar system or life-bearing planets. I think the galaxy is infected with life. Life is everywhere. Now, the question is, does it develop into what we call intelligence? I have to say, as a scientist, I haven't the slightest idea. And that's why we're looking at it. The interesting thing about the Drake equation, it's a multiplicative equation. Any one of those factors is zero or almost zero. The whole equation is very small, if not zero. But we need to march down those terms. The first one is find out where else life is. How common is it? Now, I suspect there may be something that you would call alien intelligence, but I'm not sure we'd recognize it. We see it. It may operate in vastly different timescales. It may be machine intelligence. Who knows? But I think that if you don't look, you won't find it.
As someone overseeing an organization that's devoted significant resources to listen for traditional radio signals, how do you evaluate, what do you think about these UAP hearings and the whole UAP phenomenon right now?
Well, that's it.
One of your advisors, Avi Loeb, has started this Harvard Project Galileo.
Well, this is always an interesting question, and it's always fraught with opinions. Avi Loeb is doing what I think is one of the most important things, is let's try to apply science to that. And the key thing of science is to detect real things and have them repeatable. I mean, that's the essence of science. So if somebody says, I saw an alien phenomenon, somebody else can go observe the same thing. So far, it's all been hearsay. It's somebody saw something. I mean, I listened to those hearings, and it's just somebody says they heard somebody say that it was real. Now, that doesn't mean it's wrong, but I'm very suspicious. I think that... Avi's point is that we now know there are interstellar objects that go through our solar system. Some have hit the planet. Let's go find some of this material. And is there anything weird about it? That's an important area. Now, I also have to remind everybody that what Carl Sagan said that was extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And I have seen nothing that would qualify as extraordinary evidence. But I've heard a lot of extraordinary claims. So I'd suggest that people continue to be skeptical. I'm skeptical.
So more in the realm of verifiable things, we've had an amazing last few years when it came to interstellar, two interstellar objects, and then the confirmation of the first interstellar meteor that I believe you had a role in getting the U.S. Space Force and U.S. Space Command to acknowledge. Is that right?
Yes. Watch carefully. My fingers never left my hand. certain colleagues helped get that out through. But yeah, I mean, I think there are, you know, what's exciting to me is that there are lots of interstellar objects. Now, I see no evidence that any of the things are other than natural phenomenon. But, you know, unless you look, you won't find out.
It is curious, though, reading Loeb's book that, you know, the light curve of this does seem like it would match exactly the kind of solar sail that you guys are attempting to build and launch on Breakthrough Starshot.
Yeah, with big error bars. You know, I mean, I was quite excited when Avi wrote that paper initially in the Astrophysical Journal Letters. And, you know, I think it kicked off some very good discussion. I certainly am probably a lot more skeptical than he is. But on the other hand, he's a good friend, and I respect, and he's a great scientist. I respect his judgment on it. If you don't ask the question, you're never going to get the answer. You know, I'm very excited about, in fact, I worked with him a little bit on his expedition to recover those fragments. It appears that he's recovered meteorite fragments, you know, from his expedition. He's got material now that can be tested in various laboratories. I mean, there are people that claim, well, that's terrestrial material that was on the bottom of the ocean. All right, well, we can, if you got real stuff, you can test it. And there's another meteorite that apparently is interstellar that hit off the coast of Portugal. And, you know, potentially the expeditions to collect that material as well. Now, what people need to understand that isn't really fragments of the original object. When the original object came in the atmosphere, it vaporized. But then the metal in it, sort of a vapor, recondenses in little droplets, and the droplets come down to the surface. So there's always a question of, well, you know, when you vaporize them and recondense them, did you do something to, are you really looking at, you know, what this object looked like outside the atmosphere? We don't know. I'm a great fan of that, you know, if there's a lot of these objects, if we have better space surveillance capabilities, we can find them and then go send something to one and rendezvous with it. You can get stuff what it looked like in space. Now, you know, again, my assumption is that even if there are alien origin stuff, that it's highly unlikely the first few you see are alien manufacture. They're probably just rocks. But, you know, it's always important to ask the question of, if it behaves strangely, is that, you know, one strange explanation is it's the product of an intelligence.
Now, you know, as you have alluded to multiple times, you are a scientist and you have a very unusual pedigree, especially for someone who has served as a general officer in our, what was at the time, our space forces. And I think that brings a different kind of awareness. So as an astronomer and as an innovator, going back to, you know, Clementine's attempt to go to an asteroid, and the Clementine 2, which never launched, to actually go and impact an asteroid, you had been behind what this recent success of DART, when it had a different name, I think Don Quixote or something like that.
Yeah, I forgot.
But you have been among the earliest and most consistent voices on the importance of planetary defense, including testifying to Congress. So tell us a little bit about planetary defense in the big picture.
Well, I think I find the asteroids, particularly nearest asteroids, fascinating from three perspectives. First of all, they're left over from the formation of the solar system, so they're primordial material. So they tell us about the formation of the solar system. Second, there are resources, and some of them are pure metal or almost pure metal. Others are ices and volatiles. You know, if you go get these things from the moon, you have to mine them. But if you get them from an asteroid, if you find the right asteroid, they're pretty pure material. So I find that from a resource standpoint, they're very interesting. The third one is I like what Carl Sagan said several decades ago. He said, if the dinosaurs had a space program, they'd still be with us, you know, indicating that if they've been able to find the asteroid that killed the dinosaur 65 million years ago, they might've been able to divert it. We now, for the first time, have the ability to protect our, you know, the current life on Earth. So it would be stupid not to do that. And unless we want to be replaced by something else in another 50 or 100 million years. So it's to me, there are scientific reasons, there are economic reasons, and there are survival reasons. That's a very strong set of reasons to focus on near-Earth asteroids. You know, there's always an argument, okay, which bureaucratic organization should do this? Should it be NASA? Should it be the Space Force? Should it be some international organization? And I said, I don't care. When I worked for NASA, I wanted NASA to do it. When I worked for the DOD, I wanted DOD to do it. If I worked for the UN, which is unlikely, I'd probably want the UN to do it. But I think it needs to be done. And it that's really a critical effort. And by the way, I'm really fascinated not only by the asteroids that come near the Earth, but the ones in the main belt. You know, I believe one of the best places in the solar system for a human settlement is the asteroid Ceres, which, by the way, and I get in that TV series, The Expanse, that was the headquarters of the asteroid belt. But it's about 1,000 kilometers in diameter. It apparently has a lot of volatiles and other things. The gravity would be about 4% Earth normal. So for fat old people like me, it really feels good. I think planetary defense is a very serious thing. When I was on active duty, we tried to push it, almost got it as a new mission. Although, as I understand, in the final discussion in the Joint Chiefs Requirements Council, that the Marines thought it was some sneaky Air Force trick to get more money. So they vetoed it.
I mean, that is a fascinating piece of history, you know, that was that U.S. Space Command that took it as a proposed, yes, joint requirement?
Yep.
They you went know, to the, it just I strikes said the Marines, me as...
I normally like Marines, but in this case, they were being jerks. I mean, the Air Force didn't want it either. They just didn't say anything about it because they knew they'd have to pay for it.
So let's talk for a moment about... before I do that, you know, I think it's interesting to note that in Space Command 1.0, planetary defense was championed. They actually paid for a CONOPS to be developed. They submitted it as a joint requirement. They thought about it as part of their strategic plan. And in fact, you know, the Air Force at the time developed the term planetary defense, wrote about it in Spacecast 2020 and Air Force 2025. But, you know, it's amazing that there appears to be like no advocacy by guardians today, either in the Space Force or U.S. Space Command. Why do you think that is?
Well, it takes some advocates in the system. I'm happy if I find some young officers that want to talk to me. I'm happy to help encourage them to push it. I think there's certainly a number of people that would. You know, there's a lot of other challenges too. So you always run into the argument that actually was used when I was doing this, trying to get it through was, and a couple, you know, smart and very senior people said, well, look, how many people have been killed by asteroids? I said, well, I don't know, maybe one or two. And that's stretching the point in the whole planet. And I said, well, when did this thing happen that killed the dinosaurs? Well, that was 65 million years ago. So the answer was, do you think we can defer this particular problem until next year's budget? What's the risk of doing that? And, you know, you can say, okay, you can say that about anything that's long range until it happens. But I think the conclusion was that what we really probably need to do is, rather than push it as an independent mission right now, given all the other arguments, is to tack it on to the requirements for space domain awareness and say, look, the system that will figure out what's going on in cislunar space will also find these asteroids. And that should be explicitly part of that mission. And I think that's quite feasible to occur. I mean, again, they haven't asked me my opinion. You know, I said I'm a old retired guy, you know, living in Europe most of the time, so they probably won't, but.
So, you know, speaking of Europe, I think that you have been part of sort of establishing the whole idea that asteroid mining could be a thing and encouraging that. So talk to me a little bit about your role in advocating for us mining asteroids.
Well, it's an interesting long story, but and I probably give you this, and then I probably need to sign off. But the when I was the director at NASA Ames, you know, I was a big enthusiast for bringing a lot of people in from around the world and International Space University and other places. And so we actually had, I'd met a fellow that had, he was at the International Space University in 2009, and we had at NASA Ames. And he was a Luxembourger, and he had a PhD in astronomy. And so we hired him in our mission design center. And one thing I soon discovered about Luxembourgers is they love good wine, as I do. So he was over to my apartment having a glass of wine with some of the other students and young people. And he said, well, you should go visit Luxembourg. And I said, isn't that little country between Germany, France, and Belgium that has cheap gas and low-cost booze? And he said, yeah, that's it. He said, but they're also a very rich country. And he said they were interested in space. And I said, oh, come on now, you know, 600,000 people. And he said, no, really. And he pointed out that in the 80s that Luxembourg had sponsored the SES, which is now the world's largest commsat company. And it's actually based in Luxembourg. So I said, all right, I went to visit. And there was enough interest, they invited me back to meet some of the ministers. And one of the ministers was the Minister of the Economy, who was soon to become the Deputy Prime Minister. And he said, look, we're very interested in working with NASA. Let's talk about various ideas. And so I talked about a number of things. Now, he claims he thought I was nuts when I talked about space mining. But actually, I found out his family had been involved in mining in the last century. So he was more interested than he said. So we agreed eventually to do a series of workshops on mining asteroids and the moon. So we had three of them, two of them at NASA Ames and the third one in Luxembourg. This was right, you know, in 2014, 2015, when I was leaving NASA. But the second workshop was held at NASA Ames, and he showed up, the Deputy Prime Minister, and the Prime Minister showed up as well as the Minister of Justice. And these workshops, it was pretty clear there was a real there in the next decade or two. I got sort of a frantic call from the NASA administrator, Charlie Bolden, and said, I understand you have the entire government of a NATO ally at your center. And how come I didn't know about it? And I said, well, your head of external affairs okayed it. He says, really? And so I quickly sent him the email. He says, all right. You know, because he was always concerned that I was out of control. They decided to go ahead and start their space program, which is really an investment agency, not a traditional space program. After my year cooling off period was up, the Luxembourg government asked me to be an advisor to them on the space resources. So I'm the American advisor, still am. The Deputy Prime Minister became one of my best friends. I bought my apartment from him. He's the Etienne Schneider. But they've done really well. They've got over 80 startups. About 20 of them are related to space resources. They expect by the end of this decade, some 10% of their GDP to be space oriented. They've worked global consensus that we can do space mining. Very effective ally and friend of the U.S. And it's a really neat country.
So I know you've got to go.
You visit.
If you had time, I actually want ask two questions. One sure. was, we had a conversation a while ago about the attempt, you know, circa 2000 to start a space force and why it didn't happen. And I wanted to give you a chance to broadcast that to a larger audience, because I think that's a particularly interesting story now. And then the last question will be about your message to young people. But let me ask you first about Space Force. Why didn't it happen? And how was it about to happen? What happened?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, I was a strong advocate of it, but I think that, you know, these are the kind of things that if they're quiet, then you get almost to the point. And then sort of the, you know, the elephants wake up, or the dinosaurs more likely, and they begin to, you know, get very concerned about it. It is about money and budgets. And you know, I was a, you know, at that period, a brand new one star, the senior leadership of the Air Force, when they finally figured out I was about to do something that Billy Mitchell did to the Army, I was effectively gotten rid of as well. You know, there was a lot of other things to that. You know, it's bureaucracies are bureaucracies. And the and I think most bureaucrats regard, you know, that any budget is a zero-sum game. And so you can get almost to the point where they let you do something, and then it's like, well, wait a minute, it's going to cost us something. You know, where this money coming from? The Congress isn't going to give us more money. And then you begin to have people that just don't like new ideas and start making fun of it. You know, this is sort of science fiction. You know, but I think that each one of these attempts, it takes four or five times before something works. So, you know, I guess my advice to somebody that wants to change the world is, you know, first of all, you got to be ready to be fired a lot of times. And what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, although occasionally they might actually kill you, at least professionally. But so my advice is never give up. And if you can't punch through something, find another route. I guess the other thing is, and this is probably the most famous not known Air Force strategist was John Boyd. He was a fighter pilot in the 50s, and in the 60s, he was responsible really for the F-16 and the A-10. But he retired from the Air Force, and he came up with something called the OODA loop, if you can do your observe, orient, act, or decide, act inside the adversary, you're always going to beat them, whether it's in business or military or whatever. But there was one thing that he did that I thought was very important. And when somebody wanted to work in his little group of troublemakers, he'd ask them, he said, do you want to be someone or do something? And he meant, do you want to be the chief of staff of the Air Force, or the, you know, chief of space operations, or the secretary of this, or the CEO of that company? Or do you want to do something? And do you want to change the way we do things? And, you know, I mean, it's nothing wrong with whatever you decide. But to my mind, the people that are going to do something are much more important. And that so you have to stay consistent with that. Is that, you know, decide what you want to do with your life and don't never give up.
Well, that's a perfect someone, segue. There's not much
advice. If you want to be someone, there's not much advice I can give you, you know, to talk to Elon Musk or you know, President, you know, Biden or somebody.
Well, that's a perfect segue into my last question. So, you know, I've often, you know, looked to you as an inspiration. And your leadership style, which, you know, seems to always be to look out at what's important and not always urgent, to constantly be building a network. And you've been particularly open, you know, you create these flat organizations, are very accessible. You're always open and are known for mentoring young people and starting up, you know, educational organizations. I know you had a role in the International Space University. And I remember when I was a major and I met you at the Stay for ISDC, introduced by Brad, who unfortunately has passed away recently. But I remember you told me at the time, you know, that writing was important, that you needed to write. And you also were very encouraging to get involved. I think we were like in a, you know, in probably a thousand people. There was you, a general officer in uniform, and there was me and Major, and there was basically nobody else at the time. So there, I think we have a significant young audience. So what is your advice to them? What is your mentorship to somebody who wants to do things?
Well, if it's moving us interstellar, then I'll be happy to help you. And you know, there's a lot of different ways that you can do things. You could, I mean, in some sense, I mean, Elon might be a good example. I think he made money because he does want to do something. He wants to, you know, settle Mars. So, you know, he's probably not a good example of somebody that wanted to be someone. He wanted to do something. But it's, you know, doing the best you can to develop your professional capabilities. you know, I'm a big believer in advanced degrees, particularly PhDs. You know, it doesn't have to be in a technical area. I mean, you know, my current staff, there's only one engineer. The rest of them are all sort of humanities and social sciences. My assistant is a lawyer, a space lawyer. God, I hate lawyers, but he's done a good job in helping me. But I think the other one is figure out what your vision is. What is it that gets you out of bed every morning? And if, like I said, if it's interstellar, I'll help you. But as I told you, you know, write things down. You know, you can only talk to so many people, even on the internet. But if you write things down, it's forever.
Well, Dr. Warden, thank you so much for your time. I think we'll have to leave, you know, fusion and geoengineering and, you know, starships and a lot more for a future conversation. But I really appreciate you sharing this this big picture overview of everything from cislunar to asteroid mining to planetary defense to interstellar.
Sounds good. Happy to chat again. Have a great weekend. Great. Bye-bye.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Space Strategy Podcast. Please be sure to subscribe wherever you're listening. For questions and comments, please reach out at spacepod@afpc.org. Thank you for listening.